This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. And on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. When Anna, the protagonist of Lexi Freeman's hilarious and biting satire, The Book of Ayn, finds herself canceled after penning a black comedy about opiate addiction, she falls into the lap of a group devoted to the study of the works of Ayn Rand. A surprise to her and just about everybody else, Rand's novels and philosophy appeals to Anna's wounded self-conception and her desire to be visible as a writer and thinker in a culture that would prefer that she slink away. And so she endeavors to become a Randian, embracing self-interest and egoism as the root of the human capacity for creation. Anna will test out her new philosophical canon in a series of increasingly uproarious interactions with the canceled, the culture makers, and in the farcical everyday circumstances of living in New York and LA. But when Rand's life and work reveal their hypocrisies, Anna will find herself drawn in the direction of spiritual meaningfulness and to a cultish communal love utopia on the island of Lesbos in Greece. There, a different kind of master will attempt a new indoctrination with a similar promise of contentment. But rather than professing the goodness of egoism, Anna will now be asked to kill her ego and live for things outside of her self-need. The Book of Ayn is a satire that doesn't shy away from asking profound questions about how and why we shape ourselves to fit the mold that society presents us with. And while Anna's odyssey through Randian and quasi-enlightened thinking mostly reveals the double standards that dominate any set of beliefs that promise freedom, she does indeed find herself changed in the process of adopting and leaving them behind. A side-splitting reed that blazes with a poison pen that spares no one, the Book of Ayn feels perilously well-suited to our present moment. Lexi Freeman is also the author of the novel Inappropriation, long listed for the Center of Fiction First Novel Prize and the Miles Franklin Award. She's a graduate of Columbia's MFA in Fiction and worked as a fiction editor at George Brasillier for 5 years. She also writes for television. Welcome to Burned by Books, Lexi.
Thank you. Wow, what an amazing description of the book. That was so good.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for being here. I want to start with a question about Ayn Rand, who I believed had been dead and buried as a cultural totem. Even the Randian high school boys seem to have given her up in favor of others. And I'm wondering why you decided to awake the sleeping giant and what brought her as an intertext into your novel.
I think I just was interested in her because I kind of felt like I had tackled identity politics with my first book, and I wanted to sort of attempt maybe the impossible, which is like looking at the sort of the parts of capitalism that we might have more sympathy for or kind of interest in on the left, because I assume my readers are on the left. And so I thought that was kind of, a little bit of a challenge to try to make the kind of godmother of libertarianism and free market capitalism likable or at least compelling and sympathetic in some way. So I think that was the challenge I set myself. And also I was just interested in her because I knew a little bit about her biography, and I thought she was an interesting character as a woman who had, achieved pretty phenomenal success as a writer and thinker in the early and mid part of last century. And so I sort of wanted to explore her as a kind of, she's not a feminist at all. she's some weird proto-feminist something. So I kind of, for those reasons, she was interesting to me.
She's totally fascinating. And I was trying to imagine in her turn to Hollywood, the moment at which perhaps she and Faulkner would have like crossed paths, having both like turned to the other coast and writing. But she's so, she's very, very fascinating. And the book does a wonderful job of like reinvigorating her as a figure of fascination. When I think of characters, I don't usually think of them in good or bad terms. And I don't really ascribe to the notion of relatability as a key component for fiction. But I think it's a somewhat different thing to write the poorly behaved woman, in that it breaks an unwritten societal contract about women's necessary good behavior. Anna's bad behavior, if we want to call it that, concerns her so-called selfishness. And I wonder if you had an interest in testing the boundaries for how society treats a selfish woman.
Yeah, I think I was definitely interested in that. Interested in, what it means to be a woman who, is single, childless, of a certain age, and kind of looking for meaning beyond family or even sort of strong social connections. In a sense, looking for meaning in the way that male artists have looked for meaning for ever in kind of purely sort of Nietzschean sense. And I think that was interesting to me, and also in light of this moment, which has felt extremely moralistic, and that in a sense, the only way to justify one's existence sort of seems to be on a mission to save the world or something, like we have to all be saving the planet or else we kind of don't deserve to live. That's sort of the vibe you get sometimes if you're not posting about certain issues or trying to, in a way, make your life all about trying to help those in greater need than you, then it's sort of like in some sense that you are not only squandering your life, but somehow morally wrong.
And there's a kind of desire to cleanse out the people who don't meet that impossible standard.
Right. Yes, definitely. I think, there's an impulse, obviously, to cancel or at least to separate oneself from the bad people who don't care enough about certain issues. I guess I was interested in someone who is unashamedly not trying to save the world. In fact, just trying to find meaning in her own life. And what like interested me most about that is, I suppose, the idea of the artist as that figure, because I think there is this kind of confusion or this conflict in the arts where artists have to suddenly be like activists, and all art worth mentioning or reading or promoting has to in some way be doing something to, improve the world or shed light on a certain issue or identity. My feeling is that is in many ways antithetical to the kind of deeper source of the artistic kind of impulse. I think it comes from a much more, not necessarily selfish, just less, not very rational place, and not a moralistic place. And yes, there can be obviously there are great artists who have written about terrible injustice, and there is a sort of like, there is a, you know, the soul cries out at some level to have certain things be known, and that's part of artistic expression. But I think we've come into this weird moment where that's the only legitimate form. And I think that just ends up producing, when it's sort of done en masse, it produces something that doesn't feel like art. It feels like a form of activism or some kind of something else. And I thought that was something worth interrogating. Just that, yeah.
Do you think it's a global phenomenon? I mean, I know you're originally from Australia, but US based. Do you think it's US centric, or is this now a global phenomenon in the treatment of artists?
I think it's global. I think, definitely. I mean, I don't think it's global it's in the English language market. It's definitely the trend. I think it's less of a thing in Europe, and I couldn't speak for most of the rest of the world. But I know that works that are sort of pushing to be translated into an English language market, I think it definitely reached all corners of the globe. And in the US, we've come into a less censorious, insane moment, although in some ways it's still pretty insane. But
I hope it's getting better.
It's like readers are open and like interested in things that I think, you know, the most cautious and unimaginative people in publishing just like won't allow themselves to sort of conceive of there being this market for that.
Well, I want to drill down into that idea of what fiction and art can tolerate. And think for a second about Anna's initial fall from grace, which comes with the publication of her novel that uses opiate addiction as a comedic turn, and the New York Times ends up calling her classicist. The novel treats Anna as rather clueless as to the injury that this might cause in a country beset by opiate addiction, but it also prompts this question of what is off limits in a satire. Obviously, you're doing this play with a satire that we don't read, that's written within a satire. And so I'm interested in knowing how you took this idea of a taboo and sort of fashioned it into this kind of meta satire.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to choose a subject that was, you know, obviously a reader can see how it would be offensive. But, you know, there would be other topics that would be more difficult for a readership to kind of laugh at. So I think class is one that feels easier to tackle, at least in the first paragraph of a book. And I think it works for this character because she, you know, is someone who comes from a more middle-class, upper-middle-class background. And it felt like, you know, there is this tension in the US where there is a sense that some people's pain is not as great or not, you know, as not as worthy in terms of representation that, you know, others. And so I was sort of playing a little bit with this idea that some people might find it offensive, and then other people maybe would you know, find it amusing, or that there was this kind of tension inbuilt And also, I guess, the idea of the scatological, I think, was kind of tied to that, that, you know, this idea of shame, body shame, and sort of making fun of people who may, you know, not have kind of the self-control to not shit their pants, I guess. and that becomes like a big thing for Anna herself as she sort of has her own experiences, gastrointestinal experiences.
But she's got that roommate who's constantly not flushing his turds down the toilet, which becomes this sort of constant refrain.
Yeah, and I guess exactly. It's like which people are ashamed of their bodily functions and which people are not. I think early on in the book, one of these like hot young influencer type people is over at that apartment with her housemate and, you know, making jokes about farting in front of boyfriends. And Anna is sort of furious that these young hot women get to sort of even contemplate behavior like that, whereas some people just don't get that choice in terms of like getting to be gross. And obviously mostly it's men who kind of get to, you know, fart in front of their girlfriends and it's all fine. So there's a play there with like who gets to be gross or eventually be a body with
functioning body
that in any kind of public sense and that there's like a hierarchy there. You know, her housemate kind of leaves his turds in the toilet, which is in a sense part of his arrogance of being a cute young man who is so sort of self-absorbed. He doesn't even notice that he's not flushing. So like, I think it's playing with that from the beginning, this idea of shame and shit and class and gender.
Is that how you pitch the book, shame and shit?
Maybe that's why the Australians didn't want it. No, I don't think it's funny because I never thought of all the shits. I mean, obviously I knew there was a motif that I was playing with, but it's funny how many people have been like, okay, let's talk about shit. No.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When Anna heads off to L.A. to try and write a satirical treatment of Ayn Rand's philosophy and life, she finds the task impossible. And I wonder if Anna was experiencing or you were wanting to explore how seemingly our contemporary existence has taken on the form of satire in everyday life. I'm thinking, for example, about the transition in Saturday Night Live to having sketches that are now simply replications word by word of politicians' actual speeches, requiring no writing at all to satirize the present. Do you think we live in a moment of perpetual satire, thus making what it is you're doing quite difficult?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there have always been absurd politicians and people, you know, public facing people, and I don't know that that's so different, but I guess the difference is that there is so much content now that's available, so much content, and obviously people in a sense are kind of creating little micro satires, you know, on TikTok, and there's a lot more of that kind of humorous content that is being generated and shared. And so, I feel like it's more an issue of the medium rather than the sort of the moment. Although, yeah, I mean, Trump definitely made things more absurd. That there's no question there. So there's a little bit of that. But I guess with satire, I sort of feel like, so I was thinking about the definition of satire the other day, and I feel a little bit like there are videos that sort of make fun of people, politicians, whatever. But I think if you're like working on a satire, if you're like really, especially a satirical novel, it's like there's a sort of thesis that you kind of have to have about the culture. It's not enough just to make fun of what's happening. It's almost like that there has to be a sort of underlying argument in a way for like the direction the culture has gone in, which is this kind of, you know, absurd place.
And did you have that firmly in mind before you started writing, or is it something that emerged for you?
I think I had an inkling of what it was, and to me it's kind of about this sort of the hypocrisy at the heart of this idea of selfishness versus altruism or virtuousness, or, you know, I think that's part of what the thesis is. And I'm not writing a nonfiction book, so it's never really a thesis. It's just sort of a set of ideas that you want to kind of explore through this character and their journey through the plot. But yeah, I feel like for true satire, you sort of need, you know, you need more than just making fun of the crazy things someone has said or their funny hair or whatever, an oversized suit, or like there has to be, I think there has to be more at work. And so even when you can talk about like videos that are satirical, they would be satirical in tone, but I'm not sure that, yeah, I think there's something else that goes on in a satirical novel. So that in a sense is a good thing, as it means I think that a satirical novel is doing more than just videos on the internet that might be very smart and very funny, but yeah, there's more of a kind of, you know, through line, deeper exploration.
I want to pick up on your use of the word hypocrisy there, because I really did feel like Anna's discoveries as she goes on this sort of odyssey were about forms of hypocrisy and kind of being able to make visible the ways in which the most doctrinal parts of our culture are always riven by hypocrisy. And I wonder if that was either tacitly or straight out front part of the thesis underlying your satire.
Yeah, definitely. I guess it's sort of also about this idea that this feeling that any ideology is kind of, that it's like a sort of paradox where any truth or any sort of idea that purports to be big enough to hold all instances or all conditions kind of can't be true, or can't really, like, has to have some space inside of it for the opposite, its opposite. And that's like a more spiritual idea. And that's why I think the book moves into a more spiritual place in the second half, because ultimately I think the idea that any ideology is big enough or sufficient to kind of hold all human experience is crazy and doesn't work. And so, yes, inside of that is this idea of hypocrisy that when people stick to, when they hew too closely to an ideology, ultimately they will be contradicted, or there will be some kind of, there will be a moment where it doesn't make sense anymore, and they have a choice to defend it to the death or to be open to something else. And yeah, I think that was a big part of the journey I wanted this character to go on.
I saw that you might have had quite a bit of fun writing about the group on Lesbos, because it felt like a wonderful amalgamation of almost every documentary I've read or seen about, you know, cult-like figures and spiritual movements, all sort of wonderfully kind of working together as this Frankenstein monster. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about influences there and things that kind of inspired you to come up with it.
Well, I mean, I did go to a place that is similar in some ways. So I have firsthand experience.
Oh, wow. Well, I want to hear more about that.
Well, I mean, it's a kind of meditation center that is similar, but a lot of the ideas I think came from different philosophers, you know, different Eastern philosophers who I've, watched documentaries on or read their books. You know, what's his name? Jay Krishnamurti. And I remember watching, I actually watched this after I'd written the book, but maybe I had one more draft in me. I can't remember, but I rewatched Todd Haynes' movie, Safe, and there's like, you know, she goes to a cult at the end. And that was interesting. It was like, oh, yes, the cult, the sort of like classic cult narrative where it begins with this sort of feeling that, you know, you found this amazing community and this sense of belonging, and it's like, this is the answer. And then things start to slowly sort of deteriorate. And I was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the kind of classic. And what's that movie, Midsommar, you know?
Yeah.
It's always that sort of narrative. And I don't think this follows that exactly. I don't think.
No.
I don't think the cult ends up being this sinister sort of place. The place that it's loosely based on certainly isn't that at all. I went back this summer, so it's not that. Yeah, I think that's a sort of good model, at least for the way that you, we jump on these, you know, ideologies or belief systems, and it's all very exciting at the beginning, and then things slowly start to unravel. And I think that's true of every kind of ideology, and in a context like a commune like that, you know, it's a much faster process.
Yeah, that's very true. I was very excited to encounter a term that threw me back to graduate school when I read pharmacon come up in casual conversation in the novel. And it ends up being a point of discussion around Anna's canceling and the idea of being sacrificed for a greater good. And the Greek concept comes in, and in a way of talking about the things that we insist on as curative also being a poison. And I'm interested how, for you, pharmacon operates as a way of talking about all these different societal attempts to cure, to sanitize, to make right things, whether it's cancel culture or religions or corporatism. And I'd love to hear you talk about the pharmacon a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that section of the book, is talking about the idea of the scapegoat as the pharmacon, the sort of like the cure for the society is to find a sacrificial, you know, victim. And you know, that used to be an actual human. And then I think the Greeks were the ones who then
put the goat in.
Made the goat. And anyway, but this idea of scapegoating, I think, is sort of central to Anna's idea of herself as a victim of cancel culture, even though she's not really a big victim of cancel culture. But
no,
this is the identity that she's kind of, she's adopted in a way, is this sort of scapegoat. And I think the idea of the pharmacon, the thing that is supposed to cure the culture, will also in a way poison it. I feel like there is something to be said for the way that, you know, cancel culture and the big movements that have sort of used it, like Me Too, have, you know, in ways shed light on things that needed to be known in the culture, and have sort of, you know, created awareness in a way that is useful. But also, I think the idea of erasing the individual or an individual and a few individuals in service of a larger sort of project or for the group, there is something that poisons the culture when we do that, when we decide that every life and every individual is not sacred and is not a person to be to have compassion for, to attempt to rehabilitate, or I mean that's kind of a strong word, but you know, to dismiss people as evil and bad and kind of send them, you know, banish them. I think when you do that, you always like, you know, I don't know, but the few times in my life when I have written someone off or just decided that, you know, they aren't worth trying to understand anymore or knowing, I'm never left with a good feeling. I feel like there's something poisonous in that act. Never mind what, you know, if you don't even want to think about what certain kinds of people deserve or not, it actually just poisons you and it poisons the culture that you are trying to fix or improve, because it creates a kind of climate of fear and obviously surveillance. And I think that's kind of what, you know, we've seen a little bit in the wake of these movements where, you know, the supposed cure, this kind of the scapegoat, then becomes this like specter that sort of haunts us. And, you know, this could happen to you, or, you know, and it's divisive. And it's so, yeah, I think that idea is very much at the heart of what's happening in the book and Anna's journey. And it's funny being in Greece, you know, I feel like the Greeks love to give you words like that, or they're always saying, you know, that English word is actually a Greek word, and here's the so it does kind of think of these like these amazing words that are so profound and useful. They do just come up in conversation with Greeks.
Oh, that's amazing! That my only introduction to it was through Derrida. So I have
I'm just like that. Everyone's walking around, you know. I don't know. I think.
I have to get to Greece.
It's not really true, but it is. Sometimes, yeah, it's a real, there is like a real kind of sense of pride in the etymology of these words. And
well, before I let you go, I'd love to hear a little bit about things you've been reading recently and anything that you're loving and might want to recommend to my audience.
Sure. I've been reading. I was reading The Novelist by Jordan Castro, which is great. Lots of, he also writes about shit for the shit-loving members of Shorrock. Very funny, and it's a great kind of like deep dive into sort of addiction and internet culture and again, the process of writing a novel, the artist process. And then I've been reading the books of Hervé Gibert. I don't know how to say that, but it's like H-E-R-V-E, and Gibert is G-U-I-B-E-R-T. And I read a book called Crazy for Vincent over the summer, which I really loved. And it's just like there.
I've never heard of it.
He was writing kind of in the 80s mostly. He died of AIDS very young, and but his books are really just like shocking and so raw and funny. There's one I'm reading right now called Me and My Manservant and Me, which is just hilarious.
Yeah, it sounds even the title. Yeah, is fantastic.
Poor Bert, he's so good, and so I'm just like tearing through all. Books.
Those are great. I haven't heard of them, but now I have another scatological book,
yeah.
and a raw book for turning to. And if you are similarly interested in the raw and the scatological, well, much more than that, but I can't recommend enough The Book of Ein by Lexi Freeman. And it was a real delight to talk to you, Lexi. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Well, that's all from me for now. Thanks to Lexi Freeman for coming on the show to discuss her razor satire, The Book of Ayn. You can find links to purchase The Book of Ayn, along with all of Lexi's recommended books, at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.